Mahdi Mustafa is a political science professor at the College of St. Rose who just returned from Sierra Leone to deliver food and supplies to his Ebola-stricken homeland. He arrived there in mid-December and found that the deadly virus had changed everything. Christmas celebrations were canceled. New Year's celebrations had to end by 5 p.m. Weddings were subdued affairs. Dead bodies lay in the streets. And everyone, everywhere, was suspicious of everyone else. He says Ebola had practically destroyed the foundation of the community. Ebola, while not much in the news these days, while that is true, the scourge certainly is not over. In fact, after declining steadily, the number of new weekly cases rose last week for the first time this year. Dr. Mahdi Mustafa is an associate professor of political science at the College of St. Rose, teaching courses in comparative politics. He is a native of Sierra Leone in West Africa, where his parents still live, and we welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you here.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Delight to have you here. At what point did you, were you always planning on going home, or was there a necessity?
I normally go home for Christmas.
Yes.
Every year.
Right.
But this year around, because of the Ebola virus, I was actually deciding not to go. But, you know, I changed my mind, you know, because of the necessity of going and helping out.
When you in your mind think, okay, I want to go and help out, do you know what that is? Do you know how you can help at that point, or does that really take being there and seeing the damage?
Both, you know, of those will inform, you know, how I make the decision. But it actually came about from, you know, talking to people back home. And specifically, you know, I knew that the area where my parents, you know, live, you know, was quarantined. You know, up to about 1 million people, they were quarantined. And the news was that they weren't getting enough food. So in as much as, you know, people are dying, you know, those who are also not infected with the virus were also starving. So, and I knew that, you know, the international community, you know, was actually gearing up to go back, to go there and help people who were infected. But the people that weren't being talked about much are those who were not infected and quarantined and who needed food. Mm-hmm. So that was actually what informed, you know, my decision as to, you know, where to focus my help.
Were you concerned at all, or how concerned were you that you could contract the disease?
I was very much concerned. I was scared. But I, you know, I thought, you know, that if I'm out here, I'm scared, and a Sierra Leonean, and I decide not to go, what would other nationalities say if they decide not to go? And that was a time when, you know, my government was actually berating the international community for not helping. So mm-hmm. here I was, you know, helping to raise funds, and then, you know, my conscience would not have served me right to sit back and say, well, I'm not going, and my government is blaming the international community for not helping. So I was very much concerned, and even when I went home, I made sure that, you know, I stayed indoors, you know, much of the time. And I took, you know, great precaution. We had, you know, chlorine, diluted chlorine at the front of our doorstep, and that whoever wants to enter the house, you have to wash your hands, you know, with chlorine before you go into the house. I was very much concerned right. that there was a possibility that I could contract the virus. But, you know, that actually heightened my sense of security, you know, to protect myself from being infected.
Is there a comfort? I would think there would be, but is there a comfort just being with your family?
Honestly, I didn't even see my parents because they were quarantined.
Wow.
But it was a comfort that I was in the country,
right?
And I was helping out.
You were doing something.
I was doing something. Yeah.
This is a country of 6 million people, and some 33,000 have 3,300 have died.
Yeah.
3,300 have died as a result of this disease. It is stunning. That number is stunning. And I alluded to it a bit in the introduction, but give us an idea of how from, because this has been going on for a long time. Ebola has stricken West Africa for a very long time. So give us a sense of what got worse from the last time you visited there to this most recent time and how help was needed more.
Well, I was there last summer, actually, when it started in Guinea before it got to Sierra Leone. It actually started getting, you know, very bad in this last summer. And by this November, December, that's when it really got worse and it became, you know, alarming. And in fact, that's how it got into the international news. But by the time I was leaving, just as you alluded to in the introduction, the infection rates, have been dropping, but in late December, and January, there was an increase in the infection rate. So, it's fluctuating. You know, by the time I was leaving, it was going down towards, single digits, and then it shot up again to double digits. So, it actually got very, very bad between June and, early December. That was when, you see dead people in the street. I actually saw and I actually took a picture of one person, dead, on the street. People mm-hmm. were, concerned that he died of Ebola. I have that picture. And so... So it was really very bad, and I was really very scared, actually, to be honest, going around. But, the good news yesterday, it was only two, incidents of Ebola infection, which is good news.
We just heard at the top of the hour from the BBC that there is a new test that is coming out that one of the problems has been that the current testing takes 12 to 24 hours. And they now have a test that can take 15 minutes. The problem with it is that it's not as reliable, and maybe we'll only pick up like 92% of the cases. But the World Health Organization is hoping that at least will help screen and protect. I'm curious as to how you view the coverage that we give this issue in this country, because the paranoia that we had and was over a handful of cases, and I'm not belittling that in any way, shape, or form, but that's what made the news, and it seemed very separate from the fact that the thousands had died, almost 10,000 in West Africa.
Well, sometimes when it comes to communicable diseases. Sometimes cautious paranoia is good.
Yes.
Because if you treat it with levity, it may spread. And unfortunately, the governments in West Africa, actually did not treat it with the type of seriousness that it deserved at that time it started. I say cautious paranoia because, if it goes into overdrive, you may end up stigmatizing people, and it went into overdrive a little bit, a few people, got infected and everybody was treated like, your virus, and so that will have, a very bad effect on people coming from that area. Yeah, when I came back from Sierra Leone, it took me 3 hours to go through JFK, through immigration. It was not the immigration. I didn't stay long with immigration. I stayed long with the Centers for Disease Control, being interviewed. And, I got here by my flight landed at 3:45, and I didn't, leave till like it was at 7 o'clock. you know, and that, you know, that's how long it took me. And they gave me this phone that was not actually working. that's the funny thing about it. You know, I got a phone that, you know, I told my friend, we call it the Ebola phone. And I kept getting like text messages from students who were planning how to do their homework in college, you know. But you know, that is a lighthearted part of it. But I think when it comes to, you know, you have to see the devastation that Ebola, you know, does to a society, you know, for you to, you know, appreciate cautious paranoia. Yeah, I am stressing the word cautious paranoia, you know.
But also resilience. I mean, yeah. what you see or what you saw seems to be this incredible resilience of the people to be able to still be able to function.
Oh, definitely.
With all of this around them.
Definitely. In fact, you know, the survival of many people, you know, honestly, what I saw was not because of what the government did. Because, you know, it is because, you know, of they developed, you know, a lot of survival strategies, you know, and their resilience. And what somebody told me, and it took me a while to get to wrap my head around it, was that they told me that you can only get Ebola from someone you know. You know, and what that means is that don't even trust, you know, your closest family member. Because you're most likely to touch someone with Ebola who's your family member,
right?
You know, and so those are the survivor strategies, you know, and I give credit to the people of Sierra Leone, much more so to the people. The government did its own part, but there came a time when the people, especially in certain parts of the country, they stopped, you know, depending on the government for, you know, information and things like that. They are dependent on each other.
And there was some mistrust because of corruption. Because there was money coming in to help solve the problem, and a lot of that money was going away.
And in fact, that has been, you know, that was the suspicion of the people. That actually fueled their lack of, you know, dependence on the government. And that suspicion has actually, you know, been proven correct, because an audit report just came out in Sierra Leone saying that they have not been able to account for close to $5 million, you know, of the Ebola funds, you know, that were meant to, you know, help people. And so the people were very, you know, they have been vindicated. Their distrust has been vindicated by this audit report.
And that report showed that in some cases that the supplies of if you're buying ambulances that like a quarter of them didn't show up.
Yes. Not only that a quarter of them didn't show up, you know, they were overpriced, and these were used ambulances.
Yeah.
And you know, I saw a data of you know, United Nations buying, you know, newer ambulances, you know, for less, far less, you know, amount of money than, you know, our government, you know, claimed to have bought ours, you know, secondhand in Dubai, you know. And so yes, you know, it is, you know, and in fact, if I should add this, you know, this has actually added to the suffering of the people. And they are very angry, because now people are saying that, you mean our relatives, our loved ones were dying of Ebola. We were depending on you to provide some of these, you know, our services. And then you can't account for the money. And that is where the anger is coming from.
And also a frustration, as you point out, that there isn't an election for a long time. We're not looking for an election at an election for another 3 years.
Yes, in 2018, that is when it is supposed to happen. But there have been rumblings that, you know, the government may want to try to postpone it to 2020, you know, and so all of these, you know, things are going on. And of course, the opposition came out, you know, saying that, you know, there's no need to postpone the election. So, yes, elections aren't coming to officially for the next 3 years, although we, you know, we're hearing that the government wants to postpone it to 2020.
So let's talk about your personal story here for a moment, because as you mentioned, you weren't able to visit your parents. They were in quarantine, and they have endured long quarantines and food shortages and a lack of drinking water and electricity, no electricity.
No.
So how are they doing, and how have you been in touch, and what do you know of their current plight?
Well, my parents are doing good. They're doing well, and you know, my village, you know, or my chiefdom, you know, Peja West chiefdom, they're doing okay. And I get in touch with them through telephone. In fact, there was a time when this Ebola thing really hit them. You know, they couldn't, you know, they used to buy this prepaid phone card
yes.
units. And, you know, one of my friends who teaches at the University of Tampa was very, Professor Hollist, was very, very generous in sending, actually, from the United States, sending money to them so that it could buy units so that the chiefs of the chiefdom could be in contact with health officials. So, these are some of the ways they, you know, they've been surviving. And again, the roads are bad. You know, the planting season was terrible. Yeah, you know, because of this, they can't hunt game. And so that was actually what, you know, influenced, you know, our decision to buy, you know, fish as a source of protein for them, because they can't hunt game. Because when the Ebola, you know, struck, one of the things they told them to do was to stop eating game.
And when you think about that in response to what you did of going over, because you brought money that was raised locally.
Yes.
Some $4,000.
Yes.
Brought that money over and purchased supplies.
Yes.
Rice, fish, and we're distributing that.
Yes.
The first thing that came into my mind when I read that was, how far does $4,000 go in that situation?
Well, the Sterling currency is pretty weak,
yeah,
and so it bought quite a lot of
okay.
you know rice, the staple, and the fish. You know, we bought the fish and the oil from the local market, because we decided to buy from the local people, because we wanted them to also benefit, you know, from the funds. You know, we could have bought stuff here in the United States and shipped it. We decided, you know, to do it there, but you see, the people who received the food stuff, they understood that, you know, St. Rose and the Albany community that actually donated the funds weren't going to feed the whole village for the whole year.
Mm.
It was the, you know, the expression of humanity that was actually, you know, very, very touching, you know, and you know, the chief, you know, read the speech of thanks, that we know this is not to feed us all, but at least you're in solidarity with us. Okay, you feel our pain, and this is a good gesture, you know, to tell us that we're with you in your struggle.
Talk to us about the two organizations. You worked with the Institute for Government Reform, which is a policy research organization
yes.
based in Sierra Leone. And also, you are organizing a new nonprofit, Global Relief for African Communities in Emergencies, with the acronym GRACE.
Yes.
So talk a little bit about those and how you're involved and how ultimately you hope to grow this over time and as far as helping this community.
Well, IGR, the you know Institute for Governance Reform, you know, it's an up and coming, you know, research institution, policy institution that has actually done a very good job. And we were looking for a credible organization, you know, that, you know, to whom we can send the money, you know, so that we know that this money is going to be safe and the goods will be delivered. And that's how I chose them. But I also work with, I do research with them. For them, they really don't need my organization, because the executive director, Andrew Lavallee, is a very capable guy, and he has done quite a number of reports that have been very impressive. For instance, he just did a report on the census that, according to his report, they found out that the government is trying to fix the census to give them, you know, advantage, you know, you know, purportedly to give them an advantage when the elections come. And that actually, was received very well by the population. In fact, it was based on that report that the government said, well, if we are going to go with the IGR's report, we should postpone the elections. And then with Grace, you know, I want to focus on Grace because when I went to Sierra Leone, you know, I got somewhat of an epiphany, you know. How come I have not seen all this happening?
Right.
How come I have not been, you know, doing so much to help? And this is what gave me the, you know, the impetus, you know, to come up with this, you know, organization and register it in Sierra Leone. And we're also going to have a chapter here in Albany so that we could raise funds, you know, and start working. You know, I don't want to be caught off guard again because I thought I was caught off guard and I felt very powerless, you know, that, you know, I didn't see this coming, you know. And so Grace will be working, you know, on some of those issues. Specifically, the first thing we're going to do is to look at, you know, post-Ebola Sierra Leone. And our first focus will be on orphans. We have identified two, orphan household, you know, headed by 16-year-old because both of their parents, you know, both household the parents are dead. And we're trying to see how we can help those. So our first fundraising, you know, activities will go towards helping, you know, those orphans. And hopefully from there on, you know, we'll grow more to other areas of health.
Orphan seems like a good place to start, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's sad the way, you know, the kids were left on their own.
Right.
And they're working on a documentary on the, you know, the kids, you know, and so that, you know, when they say, talk about these things, you know, it is difficult for people to visualize it until right. They see it, you know. So that's what our organization is working on right now.
Which I think is important of why an effort like that would be successful in Albany, because you're the conduit. You're the person that's telling them what is going on.
Exactly.
And we have a face and we say, okay, well, this is what's going on. And it certainly goes a lot further than...
Exactly. And some of my colleagues have actually agreed to be on the board when we register the organization. Two of my colleagues and Father Chris.
Yes.
Father Chris has also, you know, agreed to be. I think we're gonna literally force him to be chairman of the board.
Yeah. He's close to sainthood anyway, so this should throw him over the edge, I think. That's good. We're gonna put. We have your email address here, and what we're gonna do is put it up on our website. Wants to find out more information about your efforts and about the organization, they can contact you, and we'll put that on our website. It'll be up within a half hour or so. And it is, it's our website is wamc.org/roundtable, wamc.org/roundtable. Dr. Mada Mustafa is an associate professor of political science at the College of St. Rose, teaching courses in comparative politics, a native of Sierra Leone. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate you coming in and telling the story, and I hope you can come back soon and tell us how things are going.
Oh, definitely. It will be my pleasure to come back, and people need to hear these stories.
Absolutely. Well, it's a great pleasure. I thank you for sharing your story. My best to your family, I know your students are very blessed and happy to have you back, so that's great too. And I look forward to talking to you soon.
Thank you
very much.